90% of all of the data that currently exists in the world today has been generated within the last 24 months. But what's really interesting about that is that 90% of that data is actually unstructured data.
Welcome to the Insurance Innovators Unscripted, the show dedicated to innovation in the insurance industry. Each episode, you'll get a dose of thought leadership from the industry's top business minds, influencers, innovators, and executive leaders. If you want to transform your corner of the industry and exchange innovative ideas, you need to subscribe to this podcast. Now here's your host, Abel Travis.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Insurance Innovators Unscripted podcast dedicated to insurance innovation. So this afternoon, I have the opportunity to speak with Gary Melling, the president and CEO of Acquired Insights, an artificial intelligence and machine learning company bringing new and disruptive cross-industry and functional solutions to the market. Gary, it's great to have you on the podcast today. Welcome.
Well, thank you, Abel. Great to be here.
Hey, so Gary, you know, I know prior to starting Acquired Insights, you've been in a multitude of industries and you've done a few things. So, you know, if you don't mind, just to set the stage, talk about your history and what you've done prior to launching and leading Acquired Insights.
Oh, well, it's been an interesting ride, that's for sure. I started off actually in the late 70s. Working in a variety of different areas in technology and marine geophysics, and had the opportunity to work in a lot of interesting locations as well. So I've worked in North America, I've worked on in marine environments, but a lot of it always had to do with technology. And in the mid-80s, I worked the Combat Systems Engineering Division for the Canadian Navy and was responsible for doing a large technology transfer project for the officers and enlisted men to take on a whole new series of ships. Had the good fortune to work in some classified military projects. Again, this was many, many years ago, where we were actually working on what is now, that was the precursor of what is now Google Earth. So being able to have digital enhancement videos on cameras on aircraft over different countries, and being able to flying at 30,000 feet and being able to shoot a video of or at least a photograph overlooking a citizen's shoulder reading a newspaper. So that was pretty exciting back then. And then, of course, have a background in systems engineering, particularly in military applications. I've worked in psychological research and the impact of technology on the military, on civilian life, on corporate life. Have had a little bit of time with Accenture, Computer Sciences Corporation, where we did large global ERP implementations. Really, I've just been very lucky. I've had the good fortune to work with a lot of terrific people, and sometimes it was by design, and frankly, sometimes it was just by sheer dumb luck, but it's been fun.
Yeah, it sounds like it, and for you to work on the technology that's powering a lot of different applications across the globe, you know, that foundational technology for Google Earth, you know, I think that's really impressive. You know, so just taking it, you know, from there, you know, you are now leading an organization, Acquired Insights, that's really heavily involved in artificial intelligence, deep machine learning, and you know, a lot of other things that sort of twisted into that. You know, talk to me a little bit about what exactly Acquired Insights' value proposition is and what exactly you're solving.
Great question. We run into organizations on a daily basis that have copious amounts of data. The problem is not do they have data, even though they're hungry for more. The problem is what do they do with it? And you know, whether it's financial services, healthcare, the telematics industry, there's tremendous amounts of data being generated. I think that along the way, in the absence of knowing what to do with data, we've just decided it's easier to keep gathering it. And what we do is when we work with organizations, while we certainly work in structured data, the kind of data that you'll be able to obtain from an ERP system, an SAP, an Oracle, a Microsoft, a Sage, any of the large computing platforms and software packages, we've actually found that if you take a look at some of the current research, There are certainly different data points out there where even IBM has come out in the not too distant past and has said that 90% of all of the data that currently exists in the world today has been generated within the last 24 months. But what's really interesting about that is that 90% of that data is actually unstructured data. So when you think of it from a business perspective, and we multiply that 90%, 0.9 by 0.9, what we can actually derive from that is that most businesses are only using effectively about 20% of the entire data available to them. A lot of that unstructured data, data that sits in exchanges between people, perhaps around policies or work orders or claims or adjudication or whatever it is, a lot of that data is lost. It's not being utilized properly. So our value proposition really is to come to these organizations and say, listen, you're really only using about 20% of your available data. We bring the tools and the key to unlock that other 80% of that data for you for better decision purposes. And that's really it.
Yeah, and I think, you know, as you apply that to the insurance industry, you know, I think there's so much value because in this industry in particular, you know, there's so many layers of data that's being collected. And to your point, you know, a lot of these organizations may not have access to the information that they're collecting, or they may not even be doing anything with some of that, with a lot of the data, and that's a significant number, the 90% of the 90%. So, you know, thinking about insurance, you know, as things have started to transform, you've seen telematics play out in the car insurance space and all the data that's being collected there. You know, workers' compensation, you've seen wearables and in the data that's being collected that could potentially have some beneficial application to policyholders. You know, claim data, third-party data in the underwriting process, and so on. So, you know, just thinking about insurance in particular, you know, what you find is there are limitations in the ability to actually access some of that unstructured data. So, you know, how are you all helping insurance organizations, number one, not only be able to use the data that they're collecting to gain some insights from, but also to actually be able to get access to that information so that they can get insights based on what your value proposition can offer them?
Sure. Well, think of it this way. Let's go back a couple of years. And I mean, even some insurance organizations and general insurance may still be doing this today. You know, I remember a time when I moved into a new home. And one of the first things, of course, I needed to do before I could move into that home was to call my insurance agent and say, listen, I've just bought a new home. I need to transfer the policy from the old house to the new house. You know, is there going to be a rate adjustment? You know, what would be my premiums, et cetera, et cetera. And one of the first questions the insurance agent would ask is, well, what time will you and your wife be home? 7 o'clock sound good? Great. Let's get together. So the insurance agent would get in their car at the appointed time and drive to your home. And once they drove to your home, they'd basically sit outside the street for a few minutes, pull out a clipboard, and take a few notes. And they're making some behavioral observations. They're asking themselves a variety of different questions. So they might be asking themselves, for example, how big is the lot? What kind of home is it? Is it a bungalow, a duplex, side split? You know, two-story, what kind of cars do we have in the driveway? What year and make and model are the cars? Any signs of children's toys? What about renovations? Is there a bin outside that's actively involved in a renovation? What about the landscaping? Is it a $200 job or a $200,000 job? Effectively, what they're doing is they're using behavioral observations to come to some idea of what kind of policy they're going to present you. What does it look like? What does it cover? And they don't want to come and ring the doorbell and be showing up flat-footed wondering, you know, gee, I've got a white piece of paper here. I have no idea how to engage this person. They've already gone through that behavioral observation. Well, they also know their portfolio of products very well. And as a result, they can match the two in their heads very, very quickly. So in the older days, that was fine. You could have a wonderful alignment between the agent, their knowledge of their products, and what they perceive to be the needs of their customers. So things could move along very quickly. Well, let's fast forward to today. with more and more organizations, insurance companies in particular, putting their applications for products online, where do you gather that behavioral data? Certainly, you can ask them for their name, their address. You can go through all the regular questions. Are they employed? How many years have they been with the same employer? You know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But that doesn't give the agents or the underwriters an opportunity to glean those behavioral insights that they used to be able to get when they were physically in a car driving to their client's home. So, for example, one of the things that we do is we make fabulous use of behavioral data. And, you know, a moment ago we talked about copious amounts of data. I would suggest that there are many organizations that are just continuing to gather data, but frankly, they don't know if it's good data. They don't know if it's predictive data. If it's predictive, what kind of decision support will it lend itself to? There's a whole causal relationship to how these things ought to fit together. So back to the example of the online application. One of the things that we do, for example, is if a company has an online application for really any financial product, it could be insurance, it could be mortgage, it could be anything, what we'll do is we overlay a very thin app on top of that online application. It's totally transparent to the customer. They don't have any depreciation in the speed of how they're interacting with the application form or anything. And what we're doing is we're using what's called behavioral data, a behavioral data warehouse, to take a look at how that end user is interacting with their keyboard. Now, what's fascinating about this technology is that within 30 to 60 seconds, we can gather up to 20,000 unique data points, behavioral data points, that we can use in predictive analytics to take a look, a very deep look, and supplementing the current data that's being gathered on the application form with the behavioral data to do all kinds of accurate predictions. You know, for example, if we were to approve this policy, how many times a month, or how many months a year might this client be late in their payments? Are they likely to default on the policy? On the other hand, are they good for cross-sell and upsell? Do they have other areas in their lives in which they're personal or professional that we may be able to glean some insights and then present new products to them? So in the older days, you know, when the behavioral observations were possible, physical behavioral observations, it was very easy. But now many insurance companies struggle with the whole element of underwriting because they're actually missing that behavioral data. So what we do is we bring the tools that actually gather that data. We know which data is predictive, and we can then use it in conjunction with other structured data that they're getting from forms and databases and, you know, what's the proximity between the home and the closest fire hydrant and the fire station and all those kinds of things. So that's one way that I think technology and innovation, in particular we at Acquired Insights, are helping to sort of transform the industry.
Yeah, I see that playing out really well, especially if you're able to take the insights based on how that potential customer is operating, let's say on their keyboard, to your example. Because I think what I'm hearing you say is that it can also help to create some behavioral observations around predicting potential propensity for fraud or the propensity for, you know, that policyholder to maybe file a claim or, you know, something, things along that realm that you typically wouldn't have a clear understanding of as that policy is, you know, being quoted and bound, especially if it's one of the online policies, as you mentioned in your example. Now, you know, what that shows me is, you know, your capabilities actually gives traditional carriers that are going and using the online channels to acquire customers the ability to really compete with a lot of these insurtechs whose entire value proposition is through leveraging, you know, behavioral observations and using technology to do just what you've laid out. You know, a lot of traditional carriers don't have that capability. So, you know, a Lemonade, as a, you know, for example, through their application or their their phone apps and the application to get coverage, you know, provide some of the same capabilities on both the front end on the acquisition side, as well as on the back end when it comes to claims adjustments and so on. So, you know, so Gary, you know, from your perspective, you know, as you look at your capabilities, did you think that originally you were going to be able to allow these traditional carriers to really behave like insurtechs? And, you know, what are you seeing and what are you hearing from the carriers? How are they responding to this this capability that you're providing to them?
Well, it's really interesting. I would suggest, you know, at the end of the day, we're all human beings, you know, regardless of what title and what role and, you know, what we make as a salary and so on. We're all human beings. And I think anytime a new technology comes along, something that kind of disrupts and challenges the status quo, it's always met with a certain amount of resistance. And there are all kinds of books written on technology adoption life cycles and innovators and early adopters and leading mass market, trailing mass market, laggards and so on. So I won't get into all of that. But I think how it really affects some of the companies that are struggling is that they're either uninformed or potentially misinformed. And let me spend just a minute on that, because I certainly don't mean to denigrate anyone who's working and struggling and trying to make progress in that area. But I think it's important to be aware of where some of these fallacies come from. And I think these fallacies are responsible for holding companies and people back from actually enjoying the benefits of this technology. First of all, if I think of Y2K back in the 90s, and I spent years on Wall Street doing ERP implementations for kind of brand name companies that we would all know, and most of it was driven by Y2K. Well, we know that Y2K came and went, you know, overnight, and really nothing happened. And I would suggest that while it was, you know, this wonderful story we were led to believe about Y2K and double digits and calendars not aligning and records going awry and so on, I think that really the benefit of the Y2K initiative was not Y2K preparedness necessarily. I think what it did is it gave CFOs and senior managers and C-level executives in companies a consolidated look at their organization. All of a sudden now, they had systems and IT and software in human resources, in supply chain, in finance and accounting, in enterprise performance management. You know, they had all of these different modules that they could look at and use to get a consolidated view of their financials. And that in of itself is a great thing. I think as we fast forward to today, one of the observations I'm seeing, and you know, we talk to a lot of people, not just in Canada and the US, but overseas in Asia and Europe and so on. I think a lot of executives are of the opinion that in order for them to be really in a position where they can get the best value out of artificial intelligence or machine learning or any of the things that we're talking about, is that they have to upgrade all their systems, which in and of itself is a very expensive proposition. And good AI is going to work with anything. Good behavioral data tools will work with all kinds of data. So whether you have, you know, a version of software or a release that's two releases behind, in the case of, you know, unstructured data and behavioral data, whether you're running off Excel spreadsheets or email or any really good AI system is going to be able to work with whatever data you currently have, whatever the sources are you currently have. Now, admittedly, there are some sources of data that will probably need to be scrubbed, or, you know, they'll need to be replaced or upgraded, or there'll be something from the data side, the data quality side, that may need to be addressed. But that's not always addressed through upgrades, expensive upgrades in software. So the first misconception, I think, is that many business executives think that in order to embrace AI, they have to spend a lot of money to retool and upgrade all of their software. Frankly, it's just not true. I think a tremendous amount of value can be delivered and bypass that step entirely. But I think another element to why there may be some resistance is because, as I said earlier, people are people. Now, if you're a senior executive in an insurance company and you're a year or two away from retirement, artificial intelligence, machine learning, behavioral data, looking at a variety of dynamic customer journey tools where you can create customized end user experiences on the fly in real time, right to the individual, these might not necessarily be comfortable topics for you. You know, if you're near retirement, you're probably in a situation where you've got decades of valuable experience, but it's been using tools that are now going through massive transition. So your comfort level, simply speaking as a human being, your comfort level may not be there. So who wants to be a year or two away from retirement and leave on a potentially bad note if they engage in a project and the project is not successful or less than successful? So I think that there is a reluctance just simply engaging in change. There was a wonderful white paper published in a Harvard journal called Change or Die. And it simply addresses the fact that humans as a species, we just don't like change. And change in a business environment is, I think, even more suspect. So that's a second element to be aware of. I think the third is that the technology itself is going under such rapid transformation. The clock spins a little bit faster each and every day. It's not as though there's a milestone and then we have 6 months to get used to it and then there's another milestone. It's literally changing every day. So the complexity of the change, the speed of the change, the volume of the change, all of these things are happening, and it can be very unnerving. So many organizations, they're looking at quarter to quarter, year to year. They're looking at what is acceptable risk, exposure, liability. Are we working within, the constructs, the metrics, the KPIs that we've been given? And if we are, they may be less inclined to want to try something new. However, having said that, those organizations where they have leadership in place that is willing to get involved in this technology are going to be a quantum leap beyond those that aren't within a very short amount of time. And what I mean by that is if you take a look at how fast the technology is changing and recognizing that some of the younger people who are more comfortable with change, more comfortable with change in technology, and see a business case for wanting to engage in that change, they're going to be the new mavericks, if you will, of the future. And I think within 2 to 3 years, we're going to see significant change in the adoption rate. It's not that the technology is not here. The technology is here and it's proven in these cases. I just think that the adoption rate is a bit slow. And I guess there's probably a fourth element to that, which is that it's if you take a look at general insurance, for example, there are so many different ways fraud can be committed. It's really imperative to have a good risk management, a good fraud management program in place. And again, if people are managing to acceptable risk, they feel comfortable that they're meeting their objectives. I'm suggesting that this technology is a whole new way at looking and analyzing and detecting risk that in the past may have gone unnoticed or not necessarily recognized for the degree of risk or discontinuity to the organization. There's tremendous tools in place. I know we have been involved in identifying not only fraud, but the technology that we use has gone as far as to identify the physical location where the fraud occurred. We identified the machines that the fraud was committed on, and we were able to identify the people that were involved in using those machines at that location. We were able to take that information, that forensic evidence, and hand it over to authorities and actually have those people arrested. And this happened in two particular situations in the insurance side of things. So this technology is here. It's available. It's now. But there seems to be still a little bit of reluctance. And I think it's primarily behind the notion that people just don't really like change.
Yeah, I would agree with that wholeheartedly. I just go back to the example that you gave with those that are adverse to change, especially as they're, very close to retirement. I know a personal example that I remember is just actually even about a year or so ago, as there were new opportunities to involve some of these new capabilities and technology in the work that we were doing. You know, our chief underwriting officer was one that was really close to retirement. So, you know, his whole thing was not shaking up the apple cart. You know, with that said, as we introduced the new technologies, they were things that were always put on the side, right? So what we wound up doing was, doing a proof of concept, unsanctioned, of course, but doing a proof of concept that allowed us to show and prove out that, you know, introducing new capabilities, especially around machine learning and AI into our value stream could help us to identify potential areas that we might not have been able to see at all without those capabilities. You know, so, you know, we had policyholders that were hotel owners, and they were independent hotel owners, but we had the policies for each one of the independent hotel owners in this example. And, you know, what we recognized really quickly was that our hotel owners were being subject to data breaches, right? But individually, you would have never known because these were individual policies. But through this POC, we recognized that they were all, filing for data breaches and for a data breach. And there was a trend that was starting to play out. Well, you know, lo and behold, because of having this capability to see what was happening and how these organizations were being impacted by that, we really quickly recognized that the point of sale manufacturer system was breached. And that was the same point of sale manufacturer that each and every one of these individual hotel owners had. What I say is, you know, when it comes to technology, you know, you're never going to be able to get that level of data and insights through just using human intervention, because humans may miss the fact that there's these trends and patterns that's happening, whereby using technology could absolutely help you to identify those particular trends. You know, so that then brings me to the point of how the data could potentially be used. You know, Gary, so from your perspective, as you start to enable these organizations to better synthesize and analyze their internal data and then maybe pair it with external data and other sources, do you see this really changing the way that insurance carriers or even financial services industry in general would build and apply their predictive modeling for a long-term view of the impact of what this data could do?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, first of all, you hit the nail right on the head when you talked about proof of concept. I think that, if we go back to the notion that people don't like change, okay, so we acknowledge that, but at the same time, change is inevitable. So how do we introduce the change in a way that is perceived and managed with a bit more control and comfort? Again, to your point, what we do is we typically start with, first of all, we want to understand, forget the artificial intelligence and machine learning, whatever, technology, cybersecurity, crypto, forget all that. Just what we try to do with clients is understand what are the business imperatives they're trying to achieve. Let's not talk technical talk. Let's just talk in plain old everyday English. What are the imperatives you're trying to leave? What are the imperatives you're trying to deliver? And so for our purposes, if we can gather 5 or 6 business imperatives and work with the client to prioritize them, what we'll do is we'll engage in an assessment so we understand their architecture, software, data sources, quality of data, all these different elements. But during the assessment, we also embed in it a proof of concept. So by the time we're actually presenting them the results of the assessment, they're actually seeing a proof of concept in a context that means something to them. This is one or two of the business imperatives they said was important to them, and we'll now show them a proof of concept that's delivering real value. Well, the next could be either to move on to a minimum viable product, an MVP, or in most cases what happens is the value they recognize in the POC is so profound, they say, look, just go ahead and implement the solution in these other 4 or 5 areas. We're confident enough we're going to see value. Now, when we get back to your earlier question about seeing how all this technology is embraced and what does the future hold and the impact of that technology, we fast forward a year or 2 years down the road. First of all, it's important for us when we're involved with clients to be able to not only understand the business imperatives and create a customized solution on the back end. Everything we do is customized. There's nothing out of the box. There's no turnkey anything. We believe that every client is unique. And while there may be some commonalities that are shared within companies, let's say, in the same industry, insurance, there are going to be things that they do and ways that they do things and data sources that they have and don't have that will make them unique, just like a fingerprint. So what we do is we work with them in such a way to draw out their strengths and then to build a customized solution that will address the deficit and build that new business capability. In the process of that, of doing that, we learn a tremendous amount about the company and how we can help them. So as I think of where this is going, you know, most projects in the IT space, if you're talking with a CTO, it's not uncommon, depending on the size of an organization, for an IT director to have, over the course of a year, depending on the size of a company, 30, you know, 100, 300 IT projects that they've got underway for the year. And each one would go through a rigorous review process so that the projects are rank ordered according to cost and value and delivery and, you know, resources, et cetera, et cetera. What we like to do is, first of all, our clients are seeing an ROI before we even finish the pilot. And our real goal is to have the projects becoming self-funding within 12 to 24 months, compared to traditional projects in IT, where if you're looking at an internal rate of return of, let's say, 12 to 15%, you're not likely to achieve 100% ROI until you reach 8 or 10 years. Whereas with our projects, it's typically within 12 to 24 months, after which, again, the projects are self-funding. And that's a wonderful story, a testimonial for a CFO. And that's where we've been able to do very well. As far as taking a look at the future and the implications of where this technology is going, I think a huge, huge area that we're starting to make traction in as an industry, as a technology company, but more importantly as a disruptive technology, is in the whole space of chatbots, natural language processing. I think that there is going to be some displacement within the insurance industry of employees. However, having said that, I also think that there are going to be new jobs and new roles that will need to be in place. And so it's not as though I'm thinking there's going to be wholesale reductions in force. I don't believe that. I believe that this new technology and the insights that it provides is going to provide new opportunities and training and a variety of other things so that people can adapt and adopt whatever technologies they need to bring this new value to fruition. So, for example, in the case of contact centers, if we think of reaching out to customers, you know, there's technology right now. We have technology that if we know a particular client of our clients, let's say, is in arrears, we can use behavioral data and technology to match a particular contact center rep to a particular client based on the fact that we have behavioral data on both. We gathered some on the employee through employee interfaces, and we gathered some on the customer from their online application. And we can actually match the customer service rep and the customer in such a way that it's going to be less confrontational. It'll be a more amicable discussion. It's more likely to be a call that happens at a particular time of day based on what we know about the individual and their work habits and work patterns. So these are the kinds of technologies that are going to be very instrumental and really showcasing new ways that all of this data can be used. Well, one can then say, how would we use that information in market analysis? How would we take a look at that as far as observing society and customer trends? What's our customer base doing, you know, in this particular zip code area? How are they, you know, using this technology, and what can we do in marketing, for example? What messages, what media, social media, what mediums do we need to use to access our customers? And all of these are creating shifts and changes, like tectonic plates, in how all of this is being done. So I see just tremendous opportunity and much more personalized service. We're about mass personalization. And so, again, like the unwieldy ERP systems that were being implemented because of Y2K, they were very disruptive. You know, if you had a $40 to $400 million project, whether you were a service delivery consulting firm or whether you were a client, you'd typically be looking at year one as doing process reengineering, because the software did not adapt to your business. You had to adapt your business processes so that the software could be backed into it. Well, that was a year of salaries and consulting fees and licensing and so on. The second year would be the vanilla implementation of the software, and years three and four would be customization. So at the fastest possible rate, most organizations wouldn't even begin to see a functional use of the system. I mean, a real functional use, not 20% of it. It would take 5 years. And then beyond that, you know, there's the licensing and the ongoing costs and the maintenance and the revisions and the upgrades. So very, very expensive. Again, we're looking at, you know, a 100% ROI within 12 to 24 months. And on top of all of that, our systems are configured on the back end. They're very sophisticated. So we can do a small project, you know, a change to a line of business or something, typically within 2 to 4 weeks. And an enterprise solution, multiple countries, multiple languages, might take 8 or 9 months. And we can do that because on the back end, our systems are configured with drag and drop. It's really a plug and play. But we can only do that once we understand the client's business imperatives. And that's why those imperatives up front in the assessment phase are so, so important to understand. We have as much as I'm excited about where we are, I think, you know, we've only just scratched the surface. I think we have tremendous opportunities, and the technology is changing every day. You know, I read about a new application of natural language processing or using empathy in an avatar or in a humanoid robot. I mean, we have a strategic partnership with Hanson Robotics, and we've just begun working with SingularityNet. We're very excited about what the future, but I think more so about how we're going to adapt and utilize these technologies to help businesses really become all they can be.
Yeah, I think that's a tremendous opportunity for you all, especially as you adapt and then also help businesses adapt because, you know, as technology is rapidly changing, you know, helping these organizations keep up with that change is going to be important for them in order to continue the competitiveness in the environment that they're playing in. You know, just to go back to something that you mentioned around the chatbot capabilities and the potential displacement, you know, I always talk to people and when we talk about potential displacement, I always, you know, say, you know, technology, while there's going to be some, there's always the need to upskill, because the upskilling is really going to help. It's going to be what helps that individual to, number one, continue to grow and continue to learn about what some of these transformations are and how they can leverage the transformation in the work that they do on a day-to-day basis, but also to continue to provide value to the organizations that they're working in, because in essence, that's the core reason why they're there. You know, so the upskilling becomes really important, and I think that with the transformations that's happening in the industry, it also helps that individual become really transformational for that company as well. You know, so Gary, you know, to make this tangible for the listeners, you know, one of the questions that I always ask, you know, folks like yourselves, especially as you're on the cusp of transformation and innovation, is, you know, if someone that's listening to the two of us speak here today wanted to go back to their offices and do things to change the status quo, to innovate, you know, what advice would you give them in order to be successful at doing just that?
Great question. Abel, as I think of, you know, the organizations that we have and are working with, one of the things that comes to mind, and this is making it real. I mean, you know, what a moment ago I talked about executives and, you know, some of the concerns and fears they may have, especially if they're getting towards the end of their career and not wanting to take risk. But let's keep in mind that, you know, that there are far many more employees in a business that are not at that C-suite level, and they wake up, you know, they hear the buzzwords AI or machine learning, and they think in many cases about worst case scenarios. They hear about job loss and all kinds of fear mongering that's going on. And it's very natural. You know, the questions they begin to ask themselves, you know, should I be really anxious to work with this AI, or is this threatening my job? You know, it's more than just a job. In many cases for people, it's their identity. It pays the mortgage. It you know, supports their kids in school. It's you know, it's the reason why they have what they have as far as their worldly possessions. And so this is not a light topic. It has many, many implications that become very deep-rooted very quickly. So, you know, to answer your question, I think that the best way to begin to get your head around what this means is become knowledgeable. Don't, if you see an article somewhere in a magazine, in a newspaper, if you see a, you know, a 3-minute spot on a TV news item, listen to it. Get plugged into what's going on. You might initially, you know, start listening to a wide range of topics, whether it's cryptocurrencies or, you know, using AI and machine learning and detecting fraud, or, you know, the behavioral data that we talked about in underwriting and so on. Whatever it is available to you, go to the library, get a book, Google, go on YouTube. There are tremendous resources available, free resources on YouTube that help people get up to speed on all kinds of topics that are leading edge technologies. There are videos, there's PBS, there are all kinds of really good sources of information. So first of all, don't be shy. When my middle son was about 7 years old, you know, we were out for Halloween one night, and he said, "Dad, I'm not a scared." And I tell people, don't be a scared of AI. Okay, it's coming. There's nothing. It doesn't care if you like it. It doesn't care if you're interested or disinterested. It's coming. In fact, I would say it's already here. So, the best thing you can do is embrace it. Now, will you become an expert by doing that? No, and that's not the point. The point is that by understanding more about it, we can be prepared to engage in discussions. You know, whether it's I have some organizations I've worked with, and what they decided to do after we were working with them on one project to keep the momentum going is every Friday Friday at lunchtime, they would get together, they'd do a brown bag lunch, and they'd sit in either the cafeteria or in some cases in a conference room, and they would just say, okay, let's talk about AI. Let's talk about machine learning. What is it? How can we use it? What does it mean? And it's just a free form, safe environment in which people can exchange information. Sometimes it'll go on a tangent, and sometimes somebody reels it back, but sometimes those tangents are really interesting and informative. So first of all, first and foremost, don't be scared of AI. You know, as we think of people, and organizations and transformations, at Acquired Insights, we have a tool that we use to assess people. And we assess them in the current job that they're in, but with the click of a mouse, we can actually compare them to 1,000 different jobs. And what we're finding is that in a lot of companies, they've gone about hiring their people, their talent acquisition, in a very traditional, stereotypical, left to right, top to bottom way. And in some cases, it served them well, but in many, it hasn't. It hasn't served the organization well, and it hasn't served the employees well. People might be in jobs, but the question becomes, are they engaged? And often what we're seeing is that people are in the jobs because it's something they've done for a long time. They're comfortable. They know the job. But they're feeling, I would say, underemployed. They're not unemployed, but they're feeling underemployed. They feel like they have more to give, and they want to give more, but whether it's the politics or the job that they're in, or dotted lines or solid lines, whatever it is in reporting and culture, they're just not feeling that they have an opportunity to make the contribution they want. And if they could, They would enjoy their job more. They'd be more productive. The company would be more profitable. There'd be greater return to shareholders, you know, all kinds of wonderful benefits. So the kinds of tools that we use actually can assess all the employees in an organization and figure out, are they in the job that's the most optimum for them? And if they're not, what jobs might they be moved into? And as a result of that, is there some training, some development, some job shadowing, job rotation, secondments? Are there other things that we can do to help them get tooled up and ready to embrace this new role where they're going to be far more passionate about the job they're doing and the contribution they're making? So I'm seeing a trend. I certainly know it's a good discussion point, but we're actually seeing more and more organizations calling us up and saying, listen, you know, how can you help us with workforce optimization? And given that the degree of change and the speed of change that's coming, again, you know, we all get up in the morning and put our pants on one leg at a time. The question becomes, you know, are we getting up and going to work simply because it's a habit? Or, you know, in my case, I'm singularly fortunate because I'm so passionate about what I do and I've got such a great team around me. My eyes open and I just whip off the sheets and I want to put on my cape. You know, I'm ready. Like, what does today hold? What does it bring? And I really, if people aren't that passionate about what they're doing, you know, we do have tools to help organizations work through that transition in a way that benefits both the organization and the employees.
Absolutely. You know, so hey, Gary, you know, I do want to say thank you. I do truly appreciate you, you know, taking the time to talk to myself and the audience about your subject matter expertise and also what Acquired Insights is about. You know, if anyone wanted to learn more or to get in contact with you or your team, what's the best way for them to do that?
Thanks, Abel. Well, they can go to our website, which is www.acquiredinsights.com. It'll also get redirected to www.aiinc.cloud, or they can call us on our 1-800 number, 1-800-627-4151, and on our website, we have all kinds of information, case studies, use cases. I think it's quite informative, and it's constantly changing. So I thank you today and your audience for listening.
Absolutely. And I'll also take that information and I'll put it in the show notes for the folks out there that are looking for quick access to you and to your sites in the case study. So Gary, once again, thank you. I do truly appreciate it. And I hope you have a wonderful evening. And also, I'm looking forward to following what you all are continuing to innovate with Acquired Insights.
Thank you, Abel. It's been a real pleasure.
Hey everyone, thanks for listening to this episode of the Insurance Innovators Unscripted Podcast. Now, if you could take a moment to hit that subscribe button so you can get new episodes each week as they're released, I truly appreciate that. So, you know, I hope you're getting a lot out of discussions with myself and Gary. You know, there's been so much playing out in this space that, you know, I'm hopeful that you're taking the information and translating it into your strategy. So thanks for listening and I'll see you next week.